goes under the sea. The podcast for the inquisitive diver.
I tell you what, no pressure, but you are the first person to be on the show in almost 3 years that's going to talk about the Philippines in any particular detail. You better
amazing. Ace,
you've got to ace it, lady. The bosses are going to be watching this.
How exciting! How exciting!
Yeah.
How exciting. I'm super happy to be here and to chat to everybody about the Philippines, diving in the Philippines, and anything else.
Yeah, happy days. Hey, now let's start where we usually start with all the guests that come on the show. And why don't you give us a rundown on where you got involved in diving to start with? What's your background?
So I got certified in 96 in high school. This is just as fun diver. I'm originally from Israel, which is still where diving is considered cool activity for young people. It doesn't happen everywhere around the world, but it still is in Israel. People do get certified. People do consider it cool. So I got certified in high school and was a recreational diver for about 13 years, you know, kind of like diving once or twice a year on a dive trip somewhere. Went to the States, did my bachelor and my master, worked in corporate America, and did my stints in the Caribbean for diving, you know, Dos San Martin, Dos Mexico, Playa del Carmen, Belize, you know, the once a year kind of trips. And then I had a very early midlife crisis at 30, where I realized I'm stuck in a place where I don't want to be.
Yeah.
And kind of left all of it. The corporate life, definitely, the business that I've started, the US, everything all together. And I don't quite remember how it happened, but I do remember that I was at the time looking at things that make me happy. And that was obviously white sand and sunny weather.
Mm-hmm.
After living in the East Coast for 9 years. That would do that to you.
Yeah.
So when I did my dive master in Honduras, and I remember when I quit, everybody thought I was going to be a freelance consultant in the field of healthcare IT, which is what I was doing before.
Yeah.
Working in hospital, implementing clinical software for physicians and pharmacists. And then everybody said, "Oh yeah, you'll be back. Your job will wait for you after this short stint." obviously, went to Roatan, Honduras. Never turned back. That was 14 years ago.
So, is that where you did your training?
That's where I did my dive master. So I have a CMAS 2 stars.
Yeah.
So that's my initial certification in Israel as a recreational diver, and then I did my dive master in Roatan.
Nice. I'm actually going to Roatan in August for the first time.
Yay! I love it. I spent almost a year there. It's an awesome, I wouldn't say a rock because it's kind of a big island, but
yeah,
great diving, excellent people, just,
yeah,
just exactly the life I thought I would want. So did that and then guided around the world for about 2.5 years. Roatan, Mexico, Dominican Republic, back to Roatan, Philippines, Palau.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in Palau is where things kind of came together where, ooh, there's a business background there. And that's when I stopped guiding and kind of went into this mixing the love and passion for diving with a business background.
Yeah, so like sales management.
Been doing that ever since.
Yeah. You've had, what kind of span of a career was that then from actually going into, you know, I'm going to chuck some fins on and start guiding to actually doing what you're doing now? What kind of time period are we looking at?
So 2.5 years where I was guiding and after that, I landed, in Palau, and then I did, kind of a consulting project for a while about processes around reservations. I think one of the issues in the dive industry is there's a lot of people who grew in this industry and were instructors and then said, "Hey, I'm going to start my center and start working." And when you're on small scale, that can be very manageable, especially with high involvement and knowledge of the industry. But when you start looking at larger operations, I think processes are often being missed.
Yeah.
So we kind of mapped out a process of where a guest or an agent goes through from the initial inquiry through the reservation process, and how do we make that process better, also including automation. Obviously, this industry, you would go into a dive center almost anywhere and you'd find people still working either on paper or on Excel.
Yep.
And if they're super sophisticated on Google Sheets, you know? So yeah, there's that. And of course, there are some certain companies right now that are coming in and fixing that. But I think we're a bit of late bloomers here in this industry when it comes to technology. So yeah, that's kind of when it started. And then there was a bit of a pause there. I work for an NGO that was doing projects in Africa around community centers and technology education. I did that for about a year, spent some time in Africa. And then went back to the dive industry to do exactly what I do today. Did that for 2 years, and then went to run a resort and a restaurant in Costa Rica in a place with no diving. That was kind of more of the hospitality background of it. And then 7 years ago, almost 7 years ago, 6.5, joined Atlantis Dive Resorts and Liveaboards in the Philippines.
Which is where we're
as a reservations manager.
This is where we're at now, eh?
Yep, exactly. So first as a reservations manager for the two resorts and the Liveaboard, and full-time sales and marketing since 2019.
Nice, nice. And congratulations. I mean, it's a nice run of... or turn of events going through that career process that you've got there, because so many people, like you say, they get stuck at the guiding bit or the instructing bit and get stuck in one location. And I think being able to show that you can move on and you can progress to where a lot of professionals would say, oh, well, that location's better than this one, and how do you get to work in this location, and you know, just by getting on the boat and getting your fins wet and cracking on and striving forward, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, when I was guiding, everything that led my decision was, at least back then, was not about money or which island is better. It was about where the diving was better. So I got a great job offer in Vietnam. And then I went and looked at diving in Vietnam and I said, crap, I don't want to dive there.
No.
If I wouldn't want to dive there, I definitely wouldn't want to guide there. So that's kind of where I think I made my decisions.
Yeah.
And ended up, for example, Dominican Republic, I was working in Samana Bay, which was, I didn't fancy very well, very much. So yeah,
What was it like in Costa Rica?
Costa Rica was amazing.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the countries that I love. I didn't do anything related to diving at the time. We were running a resort and a restaurant in a place called Santa Teresa on the Pacific coast. So surfing, yoga, very virgin beaches. And
you didn't do any diving at all?
No, so I came there pregnant. So I've got two little ones, two future divers. And when we moved there, I was 3 months pregnant. So went through the pregnancy there, gave birth there. And then we left to go to the Philippines when our oldest was one.
That's a damn fine excuse. I was going to give you so much abuse for going to Costa Rica and not diving, but I'll let you off with that one.
I was going to dive, but obviously, you know, as my partner said, there's half of me in that too, so I do get a say.
Brilliant, brilliant. Oh, dear. Okay. Hey, I've just realized as well, actually, you're talking to me from home in Israel, aren't you?
Yeah.
I'm going to be almost on your doorstep next month.
Oh, superb. Egypt?
Jordan.
Hi, yeah. Come over. We're so close.
I'm going to Aqaba. They got the,
nice.
Yeah, they got the first underwater international photography competition going on. So I'm there for a couple of weeks.
Cool. It's a joint venture actually with the Israeli government. There was the first underwater... underwater photography exhibition, which actually happened underwater in Eilat, which is right where that tip is. So Aqaba is here and Eilat's here on the tip of the Red Sea. Very, very interesting efforts there. The king is a diver.
Yeah, so I hear.
So that's a really huge... He's a diver and his wife's a diver. So he's the one who created also the amazing underwater scenery that they have there now, because they drowned a Royal Jordanian 747 you can dive in, and some... tanks and all that stuff. Yeah, yeah. Great, great, great diving.
Well, I'm actually going as a support diver for Nicholas Remy, who's arguably much better at photography than anything I'm going to ever be able to achieve. So I'm the lighting bitch. I get to put the strobe lights out and then possibly be the diver in the shot when he needs it for those big aircraft and tanks and whatnot. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Amazing. Mm. And we definitely go dive the power station.
Oh really? That's the one, is it?
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down.
The power station. Yeah, it's so about 20, ugh, probably way more than that, 35, 50 years ago. Mm. They needed to run a line for electricity between Jordan and Egypt. And of course, what would be the best way than take massive metal pipes and just lay them on the reef?
Yeah.
That's would be right, the best way to do that. I mean, they blew up a bunch of the reef and then put the power station. Then you've got the the poles.
Oh, like the foundations and stuff.
I guess that's what they're called. Yeah, exactly. And that's underwater, mm. right? And then you've got these massive, massive, massive metal tubes. Now, obviously, as we all know, corals really like current. Mm. So that made that dive site awesome.
Awesome. I'm definitely going to look at that one then. We've got a few extra days before the competition itself to get out there and do a bit of mooching and exploring. So, yes. Good day.
Cool.
Power station. I've got it written down. Right. Let's bring it back round to the Philippines, shall we? Now, you did mention very Jeez. Briefly that you are, well, for want of a better phrase, Mrs. Atlantis Philippines. part of the reason that we've not been able
definitely
to...
Definitely married to that, as my partner would say.
Yeah, so he's still in bed thinking, oh, God, she's still doing more work on that Atlantis stuff, yeah. So, I mean, one of the main reasons that we've not been able to get this talk done or this chat done and a few cancellations is because you're zipping around all over the place going to dive events and dive shows and promoting Atlantis. So I think it's over to you. What's the best, or where do you want to start with Atlantis? Because there's quite a bit about it, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, well, first of all, it's been around for a while, so yep. 33 years. You know, I think if it's all right with you, I'd like to start with the Philippines.
Hell yeah. You go for it.
Yeah, exactly. So I first came to the Philippines 13 years ago, maybe 12.
Okay.
I don't know. It's blurry. That kind of a long time ago as a dive guide. And I came from the Caribbean. And a lot of people said, oh, when you go to Asia, you'll see when you go to Asia. You'll see when you go to Asia. And I was like, yeah, you know, because I think the Caribbean is good. Mm. You can't, you know, you got a great variety of corals. It's warm, which is very important for lots of us divers, except for you guys, people down there.
Oh, don't.
So great visibility, you know, just generally good conditions, right? And a really good variety of marine life. Mm. Lots of sharks you can see in different various places, reefs, et cetera, et cetera. So I remember I was a bit skeptic. I really was, because, you know, you're coming from good diving and you're thinking, and then I went there. I was a dive guide in Bohol. That was the first place I worked, okay. In a small dive shop. And I remember going into the water. One of the owners, there were two partners. One of the owners was a marine biologist, a German guy. And we went in there and I was mind blown by the colors, by the variety, by the number of species. I couldn't even recognize what they were.
Yeah.
So that kind of goes to, okay, I guess this is Asia for you. and it was incredible. It was incredible. And it was, I think, very, very rich in macro life, which is kind of a different way of looking at diving. A lot of people would say, when they ask about dive certs and kind of the experience of a diver that you need to be, people talk about the conditions and the water. I think it also relates to how many dives you have, mm-hmm. because newer divers generally would not appreciate macro.
No.
And of course, it's like a child, right? You need the colors and the reefs and the schools of fish and big stuff to get super excited. And then after you've done about, I don't know, a few hundreds of those, you go, ooh, interesting, a frogfish. You know, that tiny thing can change its color completely between 10 and 18 hours. How cool is that? You know, things that you don't even think about. And then you start focusing more about, you know, on animal behavior, on different traits, and how species on the, from our macro, our critters actually need to adapt. And that, I think, what a little bit blew my mind. Of course, there's big stuff as well. I mean, it was my first time ever seeing a mother and a cub whale shark just swimming together, which is unreal. I mean, the cub is massive.
Big it's already, massive. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty big already. It's like 5 or something, 6 meters or something like that, 5 meters. So yeah, it was very, very interesting variety. So that was the Philippines for me. Then I went and lived and worked on Cavigan, which is quite a small island in the north of Mindanao.
What island was that, sorry?
And really?
What island?
Camigan.
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 Where's that?
Camigan, or as we call it, Come Again. Amazing, amazing place. Tiny, tiny, tiny. The highest ratio of peaks per square kilometers in the world, more than Hawaii. It's got 7 peaks. The road around the island is 64 kilometers. So it's, you know, you go around it in an hour, maybe on a an hour and a half on a motorbike. Really, really, really interesting place to be in terms of nature. It's in the north part of Mindanao. So you ride it. Yeah, C-A-M-I. G-U-I-N.
C-A-M-I.
Which is probably...
G-U-I-N.
G-U-I-N, which is probably not... Yes, probably not as you spelled it. And okay. So, yes, that was pretty nice diving as well. Yeah, pretty nice diving, but a lot of nature and serenity. And that's the other thing in the Philippines that, you know, obviously this is a scuba diving podcast and we talk about everything about scuba diving, but the nature in the Philippines is astounding.
Yeah.
We're not just talking about nature in terms of beaches, right? I mean, there are volcanoes with mineral, like in Camigan, there's a mineral water pool that you swim in. There are hot springs all over the place, you know, waterfalls. It's just very, very untouched wild nature. Yes, it's mostly tropical climate and there's not things at elevation other than in Luzon, which is the main island. In an area called Baguio, they grow strawberries.
Okay.
So it actually does get cold. You know, it's just such a great variety of topside and underwater. Mm. And I think that's what really got me hooked on the Philippines since then. So when the opportunity came and we were living in Costa Rica and the opportunity came to go back to the Philippines, I was like, ooh, yes.
How did that come about? Because I think also the people are... Was it something you just saw advertised or something like that?
Actually, yes. So we were kind of looking at options at the time, and I wanted to get back in the diving world. And an opportunity arose with Atlantis. So, yep.
And you applied.
Literally,
and were
looking at a,
swiftly on
an
a plane.
Ad for, yay. Not that swiftly when you've got a one-year-old. It takes a while to... You don't move as quickly, then it's just you and your scuba gear, right?
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, but it was a really good chance, and I actually applied for a position to run a resort, which I'm really happy I didn't get and didn't end up in, because the operational side is less where my passion lies.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then we went back to the Philippines. We lived in Dumaguete, which is on the island of Negros, for about 4 years, which is where one of the resorts is located. Excellent. It's called it's the Mecca of crater diving in the Philippines. It's black volcanic sand. So it's darker sand. So we get different kind of critters. It's a mixed area of sandy slopes, small patches of hard coral reefs and artificial reefs, which brings crazy critters. There's 7 different species of frogfish, for example, including the hairy frogfish. And then, of course, you know, we had... there's Apo Island, which is 45 minutes from the resort, which has a really, really interesting story. It's the first and longest lasting community-led marine protected area in the Philippines.
Okay.
So it's got one of the fastest growing corals in the world, as studied by the California Academy of Science. And it's got over 150 species of coral and 300 species of fish.
So, and it's so small. I'm just looking on the map here.
And it's... Yeah, it is. It is. And you've got a wall and a coral garden. It's tiny. It's got about 1,000 people living there with no running water and no electricity. Yeah, so it's quite an interesting community. That's a community that heavily relying on fishing. But with oof, this could be a topic for a totally different podcast. But in the 70s, there was a national scientist called Angel Alcalá, which actually passed away last year or earlier this year. He studied the relationship, which of course seemed very obvious to us these days, the relationship between devastating fishing methods like dynamite fishing, gourami, nets, and all that, to the population of fish in the surrounding areas. So, of course, what he was able to prove, literally scientifically, is that fish in stress reproduce less. Ta-da! I mean, obviously, this also applies to us people, right? If you're laying at home and there are missiles over your head, you're less likely wanting to have sex and to have more kids. It's just a kind of an internal defense mechanism, I guess. And so when he was able to prove that, he was able to go to the Apo Island community and say, look, guys, we're depleting the ocean. The people who are going to get hurt of it the most are you because you are solely dependent on fishing. So slowly, slowly, 10% of the water around Apo Island became a no-take zone to let fish actually reproduce and grow. Basically, and then slowly now 100% of the water around it is obviously there's no dynamite fishing and none of that. It's all line fishing. There's no net fishing. And it took 40 years, less than 40 years. And the reefs are incredible.
I might be completely wrong here, as I often am, but is it Apo Island where where you've got to be Filipino to be able to fish there? I thought there's somewhere, I'm not sure. There's somewhere that you cannot fish as a foreigner. You have to be a local. And I'm not sure whether it's Philippines or Malaysia, to be honest.
I think on coastal diving, you wouldn't see a lot of commercial fishing. There's no commercial fishing license performed on coastal diving. So on the boats, the go close to shore. But I think in the Philippines, you got to remember that most of the fishing, not in terms of catch quantity, but in terms of the number of people engaging in that industry, it's about 1 million Filipinos per day just go on in their little bunka. Which is basically a wooden or a fiberglass or a bamboo boat with the
With that
two
outriggers.
kind of bamboo outriggers on the side, no motor, no anything, just push themselves to shore and push themselves a little bit into the ocean and fish. So that's about 1 million people a day that do that. So in terms of numbers, yeah, I mean, and those are obviously not licensed or anything.
Well, I think they're entitled to go fishing, aren't they, if they're living off it?
Yes, yeah, I think that, yeah, they are. The one place, for example, like Palau is very interesting being a shark sanctuary, but technically, if you're Palawan, you are allowed to fish a shark.
Really?
Yes, Palawans and Palawans only. To the
Okay.
best of my knowledge, it may have changed. I haven't lived there in about 8 years.
Okay. All right. I'm starting to build a little path through the Philippines on where I need to be going, landing, and
There you
diving.
go.
Let's flick back up
Oh
to
my God.
Dumaguete for a moment, because you've got the resort there, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Atlantis actually has two scuba diving, dedicated scuba diving resorts. That makes it a really big difference than some other operations in the Philippines because we are a dedicated dive resort. We're not a resort that offers diving and yoga and tree hugging and activities and all that kind of stuff. It's a scuba diving resort. Yeah, which is good. Which is good. We like trees. I'm happy with trees above and underwater. Yeah, so it's basically it's a very different kind of operation, and I do remember that from so I used to work for Sam's Tours in Palau. Sam's Tours obviously doesn't have a resort attached to it, but it's a massive dive shop where of course there's some other tours like snorkeling and kayaking and land tours, but that moment at like 4:30 when all the boats get back. And dozens of divers spill from the boats and sit down in the bar, and everybody talks about diving. And it's like people are you're living the experience way beyond the time you spent underwater. Like, think about that for a minute, really. I mean, diving in Palau, for example, or most other destinations where you do two tanks a day, Okay. You start your day probably around 6 a.m. to get ready to have breakfast. So, you know, you don't go horizontal when your breakfast is still coming up, right? So you kind of like start your day super early, and then five, you know, by the time you get to the dive shop, get to set your gear, briefing, go on the boat, travel, whatever long that takes, come back, and you just chunk like, I don't know, 12-hour days, and all you spend underwater is 2 hours.
Yeah. That's
right. So there's everything. Everything that surrounds it makes a difference. It makes a difference. The people you spend on the boat, how long are the boat rides? Are they comfortable? Are they in a place where there is some nice scenery, or are you just suffering for whatever long from rain and wind? You know, all that thing makes a big, big, big difference.
What would be a typical day then? Let's say I was staying at Dumaguete and I wanted to go dive in through the day and then have a beer of a nighttime with a whiskey nightcap.
Fill in the bits. Your mind's going to be blown. Yeah.
From when I get up in the morning to when I get back to that bar, what's a schedule generally look like?
So we offer in both resorts. We've got one resort in Dumaguete and one in Porto Galera, which is on Sabang Beach. One of the, in my opinion, one of the best diving destinations in the Philippines. Okay. Not because I work for Atlantis, because I dove the Philippines. I can't even say I've been to 10% of it, right? It's 7,641 islands.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did dive the main areas both for work and for fun. So I'm still one of those that when I have a vacation, I take a diving. So in other locations than we operate. Yeah. So it's definitely one of the best dive destinations for me in the Philippines, just in terms of variety of topography, walls and swim throughs and canyons and sandy slopes and heaps of corals and just wow. Mm. So we, in both resorts, we offer 5 guided boat dives per day.
Okay.
So the idea is like live aboard but on land. So you wake up in the morning, you have an amazing breakfast, no buffet style, everything is a la carte. Food is a very important thing at Atlantis. Thank God for that, because as you know, the army and divers march on their stomach.
Have you seen the size of me?
Perfect dive. Yeah. That's
a
beer.
It takes a lot of fuel to get this tank moving, you know.
So I think it's a very important aspect, because you can have a great dive vacation. I've seen that when I went on vacation. And, you know, I've got my special dietary requirements. I don't like to eat, you know, we're vegetarian, pretty strict vegetarians, no seafood, none of that. So don't like things to be super fried. So there are places where you go where you're challenged.
Yeah.
You're challenged.
Yeah.
So that's very, very important to have a good base of diet, because that affects your mood, obviously, during the day. So you've got a really nice breakfast, 22 menu items, including stone-cut oatmeal and things like that. So anything, you know, for any sort of flavor.
Stone-cut
oatmeal.
What the hell is that?
Yeah. Oatmeal. It's like when you take the oatmeal and you crack the shield of it.
Yeah.
With actual stones. Yeah.
Okay.
Keeps the shell on it and supposed to be more nutritional.
Okay.
Knows. Cooking a lot with coconut oil, a lot of local produce, things like that. Starting your morning with an amazing fruit platter, because the Philippines has definitely the best pineapples in the world, undebatingly the best pineapples in the world, and I've tested them, and definitely incredible mangoes.
Yeah.
So there's a fruit platter you start with, and then after that, you know, we do 2 dives in the morning, so 8:30 and 10:30, and then 2 dives in the afternoon, 2 and 4 and 6 o'clock for a night dive, because it does get dark between 5:30 and 6 every day, year round.
So the dives through the day. Sorry, I'm going to chip in every now and then just to I'll sure. forget the questions if I don't. So is there any kind of time limits on the dives, and are they done from shore, or do you go out on a boat? Or
they're all guided boat dives, and a few reasons for that. Number one, first and foremost, is safety, of course, which we take very seriously. And second is because there's a lot of macro life. And if you dive there for the first time and you don't know where to look, because as you know, when you're looking at critters, you need to know the habitat, you need to know where to look for stuff. So if you don't know where to look, you won't necessarily find all these incredible creatures. So we do have all of our guides are local Filipinos and homegrown. So from whatever role they do at the resort, from restaurant to driver to tank boy, if you want to pursue a career in diving, that is an option for you. Mm-hmm. At Atlantis, we don't hire what used to be me, you know, that foreign instructor that comes in on a two-year contract and scoops lots of tips and off they go and leave the low-paying jobs to the locals.
Yeah.
So there's none of that. Everybody is local.
Mm.
And so they're guided bow dives. So yes, there's 60 minutes limit because you've got five of those a day. And the biggest difference also is that we don't dive from bunker boats. So we don't take the big outrigger boats. We normally dive from small speed boats. So the travel time to the dive sites is 1 to 5 minutes,
bloody
literally.
Hell. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's... for people who don't like the rocking sea, that's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Ronnie out at Spice Island Divers in Ambon, he does something very similar. I mean, the travel terms are a little bit more extended, but definitely a speedboat and then drop in. And I just want to pick up on that point,
yeah,
though. You said about the dive guides being local. You can't get better. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, you cannot get better. You know, any foreigner, any international dive guide that comes in and reckons that they're better than the locals is talking right out of their arsehole. It's...
Yeah, I think absolutely. Absolutely. I think knowing the water when you grow there is totally different.
Mm.
I think some of the, you'd see sometimes the advantage to having a foreign dive guide is that you can get your marine biologists, right, to come in, and they have an extensive knowledge on the background of the scenery,
mm,
right? So there's a bit more of an education point to it. But you get that with staff retention.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got people working at Atlantis for 10 years. Right. There's in Dumaguete, for example, which is where I was based, there's three couples who met in the resort, married and our family. Right. So still both of them work at the resort.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get that when you get people who dive those beaches each and every day and year round, then you have that knowledge being built.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that's a very important point, other than the fact that even outside of the dive guides, you know, management level, everybody, there's 154 people at Atlantis, and I think we're 7 foreigners, including the owners.
154. That's over the three
like
elements we're talking about here, the two resorts and the liveaboard, or yeah.
That's the two resorts and the liveaboard, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So the resorts are medium size. There's 40 room in Puerto Galera and 44 in Dumaguete, and 16 passengers and 8 cabins on the boat. So
that's a shit ton of tanks.
Yeah. Different sizes too. All being inspected and cleaned and serviced regularly. Yes, that is a shit ton of tanks.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, Dumaguete, is there any... What's the go-to macro? Because I know I'm a bit of a macro head. And I think you mentioned it earlier on. As people progress in their diving, you kind of get used to seeing, oh, there's a shark again. There's a big cuttlefish. It's all same. And then you start to see, you know, that extra new world that's in the tiny little crevices of the corals. So I've found in the locations that I've gone so far on my macro hunts is that each destination has its own kind of celebrities. Who would you say is the most sought after at Dumaguete when you've got photographers and macro heads coming in?
The different species of octopus. First of all, blue ring octopus is on everybody's list,
yeah,
right? People come, that's what I want to see. I want to see a blue ring octopus. And it's really funny when they say that because you go, oh, really? Okay.
Just put your head in the water.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, you know, you don't make promises. It's the ocean. But most people stay with us for about a week. And then it is likely and hopeful that they'll see one. So definitely the blue ring, the Matoti is also one of them. Wonderpus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
Wonderpus and Mimic Octopus are also, yeah, mm, fantastic. Not just for photographers, for anyone, just to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're mind-blowing. we get a lot of the flamboyant cuttlefish, and we do get a lot of fish behavior in the Philippines in general, because if you don't have strong currents, then it's, you know, you can spend some time and go really, really slow,
mm,
and kind of look at the different critters as you go along. So, for example, you can see the flamboyant cuttlefish hunting, which is, okay, quite amazing. You know, they walk and they got that tongue,
yeah,
coming out.
Yeah.
which is really, really cool. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on. So I think, yeah, I think blue ring octopus, pygmy seahorse is another one people are fanatic about. And in Porta Galera, actually, we've got a really good shot going back to photographers, because we've got these massive sea fans in a dive site called Canyons, and it's about 16 meters, and you get them, which is pretty shallow, and then you can get that shot on a sunny day with the blue, kind of like really bright blue in the background. So that's pretty rare. I don't shoot myself at all, but you know, that people get really excited over that.
It's those little buggers that I think it was Don that mentioned it a few episodes ago. You get so focused on getting photos of those little buggers. They're the prime cause for going into decompression. The amount of times that
Oh
I've
my
gone into
God,
deco and not
totally.
realized. And he's the same.
Because you're chasing after, you're just chasing after that photo, you know, of a pygmy seahorse or of a frogfish. Frogfish are kind of easier to photograph, or I don't know, different, just different kind of stuff. The mantis shrimp with the eggs. You
Oh,
get the
yes.
peacock mantis shrimp, and if you're lucky, with the eggs on the belly, you know, it's that kind of stuff. Mandarin fish. So yeah, there's a lot of really good variety. And I think, to me, the reason Porta Galera is so amazing is you've got that plus the reefs.
Okay.
And that creates a very, very special destination, because mostly people kind of like have to choose, you know, macro or reef, right? Of course, where there is reef, there is macro. So, you know, there is, but it's not necessarily the focus. Like, I just got back from Tubataha, where people were trying to, you know, people were pointing nudibranchs to each other, and I'm just like, show me a nudibranch. You know, this is not the reason I'm here. But people get excited over those, right? So there are over 700 species of nudibranchs in Porta Galera. Really, really, really interesting. And then you've got the amazing topography, the wall, the swim throughs, canyons, big boulders that go down completely covered in corals. So it's just very, very interesting mix of dive sites.
And this is Porta Galera, yeah?
Which is off the coast of Mindoro, northern part of Mindoro, which is the next island south from Luzon, the main island where Manila is. So you take a van for about an hour and a half to a place called Batangas, and then either take a public ferry or a private speedboat, which is 30 minutes, and you're at the resort.
Oh, yep, just found it.
So that was one of the areas in the Philippines where Philippines started becoming a scuba diving destination in the 90s. This is one of the places where everybody went to. And actually, it's really interesting because Aussies went there a lot. And when you talk to people about Porta Galera when you're down in Australia, people would be like, oh, haven't been there in ages. You know, people know it. It is because it is that. And then I think there was some sort of a shift towards other destinations, like the Visayas region, where Dumaguete is part of, like Bohol, Cebu, Negros, kind of that area, you know, with the threshers in Malapascua and the sardines in Malwal, and kind of everything started coming down a little bit. Of course, there's Tubataha, right? And those are the famous destinations, but they're, you know, they're way more. They're way, way more.
Come on then, give us a lowdown on Porta Galera then. What's the you said it's about an hour on a bus, did you say, to get to Batangas?
So it's an yeah, it's an hour and a half
Hour and a
to
half.
two, depending on traffic, but normally it's about 100 and a hour and a half. We do private vans from Manila, and then you can either hop on a public ferry, which is about 90 minutes, 60 to 90, depending on the boat, and or you take the private water taxi, which takes you to the resort in 30 minutes. So it's a rundown about 3 hours, which is perfect. Depending on arrival time, people either spend the night in Manila and go early in the morning, or land, you know, in the morning and then off to the
Straight in
resort.
a bus and away you go. That makes sense.
And then same thing there. Like, it's we've got 27 dive spots that are 1 to 5 minutes away by boat. Crazy. It's like ridiculous. Sometimes you get on a boat, and it's really funny because, you know, you'd get on a boat and then they would drive, boop, and people said, seriously, I could have swam that. I'm like, yeah, you know. So everything is just there. Like one of my best night dives was just in front of the resort, and we saw, I'm not exaggerating, a Spanish dancer this big.
Really?
It was ridiculous. Like all of us were just staring at it. I didn't think it was a Spanish dancer. I was like, this can't be. She's way too big.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And no one got photo so proof because that, they had macro lenses on.
Possibly. I think somebody did. I think, I don't know. I definitely have it in my, very vividly in my mind going, what are you? Who is this?
Bloody hell.
Must have, you know, must have been fed well at Atlantis in the breakfast.
Awesome sauce. Now we do have a link, don't we? We have the boat, the liverboard.
Yeah, the liverboard. Yes. So yes, Atlantis Azores, built in the 80s in Louisiana for the oil rigger industry, turned into a dive boat by aggressor. Atlantis bought it in 2012, put it back in the water in 2014. She carries 16 passengers in 8 cabins. We do 4 routes a year, depending on the time of year. Tubataha is one of them. And then we spend 6 months in the Visayas, which we leave from Atlantis to Magetti. So that's pretty easy for in terms of combination. Like you stay a couple nights at the resort, then you get on the boat and, you know, the zero transfers there. And then we do the Visayas route. We go to, either kind of like Southern Visayas or including Malapascua to go dive with the Threshers.
Let me just have a look at my map again. Where's the Visayas on the map?
So if you look at the chunk of islands that are Negros, Cebu, Bohol, Siquijor, and then there's Iloilo, but that's kind of a, you know, not a touristy destination.
Yeah.
So those are called the Visayas.
Okay.
Visayas region. Yeah, and that's really famous and popular for diving. So just because you get a really good variety from fresh sharks to whale sharks to sardines to mackerel to walls to, there's everything.
Yeah.
Everything. And the movement between islands is quite easy because they're all kind of like, you know, an hour ferry away from each other.
Yeah.
Makes it really simple. It's kind of like combining on a dive trip, it's kind of like combining Anilao and Porto Galera, right?
Okay.
Because they're close to each other.
Yeah.
So, so we do different routes there, including up to Malapascua, which makes quite a big difference when you dive it off a liverboard. It's an early morning dive on a cleaning station. When you do it from land-based shops, it's going to be you and 20 other boats.
Yeah, I've been there.
By and large, it's a very popular destination, or you do it off a liverboard, you know, half an hour before everyone else as you wake up and roll over. So,
I obviously remember, you know, the dives and seeing the sharks, which was awesome. However, the one thing I do remember most of Malapascua was the amount of fucking cockerels in the morning, 3:30, 4 a.m. or something like that. No one warned me about it. It was a bit of a shocker.
That's Philippines for you. It's just, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. The Filipinos love their chickens. And of course, they love their cocks and their cockfights and all that stuff. So yes, there is. There is a lot of that. It's funny, like when you live there, you kind of get oblivious to it.
Yeah.
But then, obviously a lot of people talk about it when they go there on vacation. They're like, oh my God, there's so many roosters. And we're like, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. But not so many on the boat, which is a good thing.
No roosters on the boat.
Cool. those routes again that you do. So you got 4 routes a year. So you do Tubataha.
Yeah, so we do Tubataha between, so we start last week of February through mid-June, and then we move the boat to the Visayas, and then there's a transition trip between from Tubataha to Dumaguete.
Gotcha.
And then we do the routes around the Visaya, either like a 7-night kind of Bohol area, so Dumaguete, Oslob for the whale sharks, Sumilon, Malbal. Actually, no, we don't do Malbal, we do Cabilao and other islands around that area. Just from the typhoon a couple of years ago.
And I think it's fair to say that having a liverboard, how many other liverboards are in that region? Incidentally?
Very interesting question, you know, and it's, I just had that talk with a bunch of people on the last show I've been to. You would think that Philippines would have hundreds of boats with over 7,000 islands. No, there's about 20 liverboards.
Jesus.
How weird is that? It's like only 20 liveaboards, right? And there's only not at all. And there's only six of us, all metal boats, right? So when you go out to open sea, that's a bit more stable and safer.
Yeah, just a bit.
So yeah, just a tad. So yeah, there's that. So there's really not that many boats in the Philippines, which is surprising, incredible. I think because especially in places like Tubataha, you get a very exquisite experience. The park is huge and you cannot anchor, so you have to moor, right? And this also same in the Visayas, like in a lot of these places, we try not to throw anchor. We try to moor if it's a route that we normally go to, and other, different boats, different mooring lines in Tubataha, the park does, but in different areas, we put mooring lines, other boats put mooring lines, and we normally try not to be two boats in the same area in the same time, right?
Oh, okay.
And so that creates a pretty exquisite experience. Yeah.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow up question to see if all the boats follow the same kind of routes and the same kind of schedule throughout the year.
I think they do. I think most boats do. However, because it's such a huge region, I mean, honestly, like other than Tubataha, which is one marine park, the rest of it is just massive.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be in the same place where other boats are.
Yeah.
And that's really a big, my husband just got back from Raja Ampat and he also said they haven't seen that many boats because that area is also really big.
Yeah.
And the boats do coordinate. But there's 120 liveaboards in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot, and like 160 in the Maldives. I mean,
well,
it's
the Indonesian ones that do Komodo. They do Komodo through the Komodo season, and they all piss off over to Raja Ampat, and they're all there as well.
But it's the same for us with Tubataha, except we're like less than 20 boats, So
yes.
Just a very, very different, experience, I think. And I think the being able to have those moments when you dive. And again, going back to being an experienced diver, I went to the Red Sea last year after I haven't been there in 20 years. Dove, daily boats, did from Sharm, did, what did we do? Tehran Straits one day and Ras Muhammad another day. There were 44 day boats, each of them with like between 20 and 40 divers.
Holy shit.
I literally went in the water and they grouped us together. There was us, my partner and I, my dad, and they grouped us with this group of four Portuguese who actually work at dive center because they figured, oh, shoot, let's put the dive professionals together. And, our guide looked at us and said, look, we're going to do, we're going to jump here. Are you guys okay with swimming a little bit? Because then we're going to get off the crowds. And when we would meet the crowds, I was shocked. They were like, dozens of divers in the water and there's bubbles everywhere and there's people everywhere. I just kind of went, ooh, it just swam off to the blue. This is not, especially as you become more experienced in your diving, not as a career, just as a diver. These are the kind of experiences you're looking for, right?
Correct. Correct. You need that, that feel of getting away from the madding crowd.
And to be able to see the critters and the big stuff because they normally don't like the big crowds.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was generally first in the water and you get to see the good stuff and it all buggers off before the last group gets in. So it's,
That's the secret. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, dear. I did notice, and I think anyone who's listening to this will know already, but Tubataha is extremely popular. And as Ronnie's already said, it's very limited on when you can go and dive it. What's the lead time on people wanting to get on board of the boat for Tubataha at the moment?
Oh, we're sold out this season. And then next year, we only have a few spaces and 1 week left.
Yeah. So literally 2 years in advance kind of thing.
A year to two at minimum, unless you want to wait last. This is for the good boats. This is for the good boats, okay? Yeah. Unless you want to wait for last minute cancellations, which, there's a space here, there's a space there. But I think lots of people are like, look, I got to take my leave. It's a week. We also do 7 nights versus 6 nights, which most other boats do to get another trip in. So we do 22 dives in Tubataha. And So, I think, definitely a year to two.
Yeah, yeah. start getting my name down now, I think.
yeah, this is really that, you know, people would contact me and be like, hey, you know, we want to do a full charter next year. I'm like, okay, we're taking bookings for 2026 now for full charters.
Yeah. Are you really?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, the good boats, it's very, very different. It's a very different world. And granted that it's a 14-week, 15-week season, half of that season is filled with our repeaters. So people come back every year.
Yeah.
For example, dive shops would do a Dubataha trip every year, not necessarily with the same people, but because people want to go, then they would book that in advance.
Yeah. Okay. And it holds 16 people, did you say?
16 people. Yep.
Okay.
Eight cabins.
I need to nail something down then, don't I?
Which is quite an exquisite. Yeah, it's kind of, again, going back to the fact that there are two boats are on the same place.
Mm.
If you have a boat with 24 people or a boat with 16 people, it makes a big difference, right? Mm.
Well, I mean, I kind of know what you're talking about with Dubataha, but for those people that are listening, do you want to nail down why it is so popular? I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, hold on a minute. There will be people who are not sure what that location is. What's so popular about Dubataha?
Right, so there are two atolls in the middle of the Sulu Sea. They're 90 nautical miles away from any land. They're the largest marine park in Southeast Asia. I think, yeah, size-wise. And they're very, very well protected. The atolls have drop-offs. So the plateau, depending on the current, on the tides, would be anywhere from, you know, 10 to 18 meters on the plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And then it drops to walls of like 900,000 meters. So very, very deep, very, very blue, currents, you know, so everything that comes through the Philippines, if you open the map of the Philippines, that kind of takes it back to why the Philippines is so special. If you open the map of the Philippines, you will notice that it's situated between the Pacific Ocean and basically four large bodies of water. So the Pacific Ocean on the east, Celebes Sea and Sulu Sea on the southwest, and then the north, West Philippine Sea or South China Sea, depending who you ask, same sea, different names, on the northwest. So those four large bodies of water, basically water from the open ocean, rich in nutrients, come in and funnel through the islands of the Philippines. So we're also on a meeting point of two major oceanic currents, which is the North Equatorial Current and the Pacific Current. So again, water from open ocean come in, rich in nutrients, and go between the islands, right? The channels between the islands are normally around anywhere from 100 to 300 meters deep. So there's a lot of water, right? And then the nutrients obviously settle kind of like on the walls or slopes of the islands to create really, really rich habitats. And that's why also our corals are the fastest growing corals in the world. It's because there is a temperature difference. You know, even with global warming, the water does not get a 30 degrees Celsius for a long period where it damages the corals, right? Mm-hmm. It funnels. The water funnels and colder water. Like, I was just in Dubataha in April, and we had some upswell, like 25 Celsius.
So, that's positively toasty down
this
here.
This is for us. Oh, my God. For us, it's like... Like I wouldn't even go diving in that kind of temperature, but you know, you get those currents coming in, and so that what makes it so, you know, biodiverse and healthy, right? Mm. So Dubataha is that with the drop-offs, just insane corals, insane. They sea fans that are like 3 meter diameters, and just everything is big, everything is colorful, you know, lots of schools. So there is that. And of course, the fact that you can't get there makes it lucrative, right? Like, why do people, I don't know, who's a top model these days, man? I'm like, so off.
Me?
Off the people. You, of course. That's why Matt Waters is so desirable. And that's why it takes so long to schedule a podcast with him, because there's only one of him and everybody wants it. Go, you know, so... That's Dubataha. Matt, you are Dubataha.
There you go. Yeah. I'm just having a look on the map here, and I put it on the old Google thing that shows you
the old
topography, and it's actually very interesting. You can see how that those channels, like you say, that are going to be bringing that nutrient rich water through, and it all sits on one big spine.
Well, Yeah, well, just have a look not only at Tubataha. So have a quick look at the Verde Passage. Verde Passage,
Verde
right? So that
Passage.
is basically the point, yeah, between Verde Island. The middle of it is Verde Island, which is, after incredible studies, has been proven to be the number one most biodiverse point in the world.
Which one's
Okay,
Verde
this is by
Island?
the
Whereabouts is
California
it
Academy of Science.
from
So
Tubataha?
just Google Verde Island. No, don't look at Tubataha. This is a totally different destination.
Okay.
Go to just Google Verde Island.
Doing it now.
And when you'll find it, you will find it very shortly. And when you find it, you will learn that this bugger is located in the middle of the Verde Passage.
Oh, this is up near
And
Porto
the
Galera, yeah.
there you go, right? So you've got Analao, you've got Porto Galera,
Yeah.
and in that area is Verde Island, so the most biodiverse point in the Philippines, as the California Academy of Sciences declared
Okay.
after their study. And what makes it so unique is the fact that it sits, if you look at where it's sitting, going back to this discussion about currents, if you look at where it's sitting, right, it's sitting, you can see that the water is coming in from the West Philippine Sea or the South China Sea, right? We've just been to
Yeah.
this discussion. So that's where the water's coming in.
That's
So
on
these
a good
guys,
funnel as well, isn't it?
exactly. So what you get there is currents. Currents that come in, water rich in nutrients, everything kind of like funnels through that channel, that passage, we call it a passage, and then that goes straight into the area of the inner islands like Romblon, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same thing in Tubataha if you look at the location of it, that because water comes in really rich in nutrients, and then they find these two atolls, and then you've got all these corals, right? So that's where your habitat becomes very unique,
Yeah.
right? And so that it's true, and I will kid you not, Verde Island is one of the best, hands down, dive sites. It is
Okay.
unreal. It's pinnacles rising up from 150 meters, going all the way to the surface. You can only see the tip. So you see this tip triangle of black rocks, right? And then it goes down like this, dunk, and then there's a little plateau, and then boom, and then the wall goes down to about hundreds of meters deep. There are clouds of red-toothed triggerfish. It's unreal. It's unreal. It's like a dream. It's a dream. And every time I go there, I just go, oh my God. And it's really funny because, like I told you, I just got back from Tubataha a second time. And I was literally diving through this cloud of red toothed triggerfish. And I just went, the same feeling. So, yes, of course, Tubataha is amazing. It's amazing because it's remote.
Yeah.
It's amazing because there's no people, there's no land. You're on a boat for a week. You get off the boat once to go on land.
Yeah.
That's not even on land. It depends on the tides, right? So we go to the ranger station to visit the rangers, but obviously, their house is a house on stilts. So on low tide, it's just nothing,
Yeah.
right? So it's just water, 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 and some more water. So that experience is really unique. And of course, the size of the corals and just a variety of there's heaps of sharks everywhere, everywhere.
That's what I was going to ask next is the sharks, what kind of sharks? And I've got a there's one chap, he's a good mate now. He started out as a guest, and he's only ever happy when he sees something, big and
Some,
sharky.
yeah.
You can be on the best
Right.
dive in the
So,
world, he'd be like, yeah, it's okay. But if a shark turns up, he's got a big cheesy grin on his face.
right. So I think sharks in the Philippines, look, on coastal diving, we don't get that much.
Yeah, for the
A
obvious
million
reasons.
Filipinos for obvious reasons, right? And obvious reasons that also go back to our dive industry because, like again, I'm not, and there's no judgment in what I'm gonna say. But you do go and people go on vacation, they would sit and be like, oh my God, amazing tuna steak. And then they go back from, and then they go diving and they get back and they're like, oh, we didn't see anything in the water. And you're like, yeah, it was just on your plate. So there's obviously a very strong correlation. between what you see in the water and what you have on your plate. So I think, you know, Tubataha is a marine park. It's protected. You do get all your gray reefs, black tips, white tips. Normally, we do get quite a few whale sharks there. This season, less than prior seasons. And we saw what well, we did see two hammerheads, which I've never seen there. So there are hammerheads there. Mantas, all sorts of ray, marble rays, eagles, you know, all sorts of big animals. And then tunas, massive,
Brilliant.
freaking huge tunas, barracudas, jackfish, just schools, parrot, bumphead parrotfish, the big one, you know, like just all sorts of big stuff. Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to talk, I wanted to ask
And
about
then you've got
the
those people looking for nudibranchs.
Yeah, I think I'd save that for, you know,
Sorry, it's
back
just
up north, you know, Tubataha. It's got to be wide angle for sure. I
Yeah.
was going to ask about, I am going to ask about, what's it called? Oslob and the whale sharks. Now, I went there years and years and years ago when I didn't know any better. And I've got to say, it was surprising and quite alarming at the quantity of people getting in the water to swim with whale sharks. Obviously, it's good for the locals because they're turning some good coin. But one thing that's always stuck in mind is the whale sharks, are they getting used to hulls and are they getting damaged by other boats when they leave that kind of area? And I'd be intrigued to know what your kind of opinion on Oslob and the way the whale sharks have been used, I suppose.
Treated, I think. Let me ask you with a different. Let me
Treated,
start with a different question.
yeah.
Also, for the people listening, do you go to zoos?
No, but
Neither do
kind of,
I. Neither do I. So that's kind of like a very different breed of people, because 90% of the people would go to zoos. I think divers wouldn't go to SeaWorld and aquariums. Although I will tell you, I was insanely surprised to hear how many people go and dive with the whale sharks in the Georgia Aquarium, where a 20-minute dive is $425, and dive shops arrange trips there. So to me, that is, you know, it's a, Oslob is an open ocean. The feeding is done 3 hours a day, so nobody's forcing the whale sharks to be there. That's to begin with, right? I think studies are still being done, and now also partly funded by the government there. The local government was alarmed and required to devote some of the humongous income to sharks, to whale shark research. So there's always, like, you'll see, especially now, like the last couple of times that I went since after the pandemic, you do get more, you will see marine biologists in the water, kind of like observing and swimming with the with people and just looking at the behavior of the sharks and stuff. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Matt. That's a complicated question. I mean, this is goes back to my, hey, how was your tuna steak? Right? We are people and we have desires, and people just go, hey, where's my bucket list? You know, it's no different than poking a blue ring octopus, so the blue rings come out and you can get a nice photo. It's no different.
I mean,
It's no different. It's just that one is smaller.
I mean, I'm not trying to put dispersions on anyone who goes there now, because you know, I was one of those people. I knew no different, and I just wanted to see the whale sharks.
But plus, it's well managed, Matt. It's really well managed. Like, it's one of the only places in the world where you go and there are actually dozens of people in the water from the operation. If you go too close, they will tell you to go far. If you shoot with a flash, they'll tell you to stop. If you try to touch a whale shark, would you be surprised how many people do try to? There's actually a prison. It's actually in the law in the Philippines. You're not allowed to touch them.
Oh, good.
And you can get a fine and you can go to prison up to 4 years. It's in the law. It's actually a
Awesome.
pretty big animal. The buntag, as they're called in local language, in Tagalog. They're on the 100 pesos bill as well. So they're quite part of that theme.
Popular.
It's not
I've
much you
also
can
got to
do.
put a caveat on it that I actually was at an aquarium 2 days ago, because we took some disabled divers diving with not with whale sharks, but with nurse sharks.
And you know, and that kind of goes to, where do you draw the line? You know, some people say, oh, we'll all draw the line. You know, aquariums are actually saving, they're actually saving, I don't know, endangered species. And it's important that for the education side of it, it's important when we take kids there so they can get connected with the water. You know, I took my son to swim with the whale sharks in Oslo probably about 10 times, you know, since he was 2.5, like put his head in the water and he's like, oh my God, it's going to eat me. I'm like, it's not going to eat you. Oh, it's going to eat me, because it's a big mouth, right? You know, it's hard. It's hard where to draw the line. You do also have to remember that we, and especially people listening to this podcast, we're divers. We know the ocean. We love it. Then 90% of the people going to Oslo are locals or Chinese and Koreans. You know, people who would not necessarily ever be in the water in that scenario, who probably have very likely seen more dead fish than any fish alive. Right? Dead fish in their plates and in their food. So there is that aspect as well. I don't know where to draw the line. You know, it's a very fine line. I think we each define it to ourselves. And I think relatively speaking to compared to, you know, aquariums and zoos and a distressed environment in that sense. It's definitely better because the whale sharks are migrating through. They're free. They don't get enough food to stick around.
Yeah.
Forever. Like to be kind of like your pet whale shark.
That would be a lot of food around. To sustain an adult whale shark.
That would be a lot of food, yeah. And you know, there are no motorboats in the area. There's only the bunker boats with the rows, so don't know. It's a tough one. Lots of people do it, and the people who don't want to do it don't do it.
Yeah. So is there any other hotspots for sand whale sharks? For divers,
right? Absolutely. Oh my God.
You can't dive with them, can you?
You can. Can we dive with them off the liverboard? Yeah, we dive with them off the liverboard, not offshore, just because the local operations there are not at par with our safety requirements. So we don't do that. We used to be able to do that off our bunkers when we do the cross island, but we can't cross island with bunkers anymore. Since 2019, the rules change with how far bunkers can go. So, so we can't do that. We used to do that with bunkers or with a liverboard. I think there are definitely other spots. Tubataha is one. And then you've got Southern Leyte. So if you look at Southern Leyte on the map, Southern Leyte, L-E-Y-T-E. That's also part of the Visayas region, but it's the furthest east. And that's basically where the Pacific Ocean is. So that's where they would funnel through, coming in, right?
Well,
and then there's Donsol.
A nice deep channel out there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that is also snorkeling. They're very well protected there, and you can't dive with them. It's snorkeling, basically. We did a trip there on a liverboard last December, which we're looking to do again in 2024. And that will be led by Dr. Gonzalo Araujo, who's a shark researcher and a PhD in marine biology. Spent 7 years in the Philippines studying migration of sharks. So he's leading a trip which is very educational, and we do Malapascua and Southern Leyte to go see them in a bit more of a natural environment. And then there is Donsol, which is also a place where people do see them, and but that's seasonal. Right.
Yeah.
So I think what people, and also Southern Leyte is seasonal. The most sightings are in December and January. So it's a, you know, look at us today. I mean, I'm just looking at you. I've got my screen and I've got about 27 other Chrome windows open. Like, we want everything now and everything instant. And, you know, I was just on a week in Tubataha. We had freaking incredible dives, and literally people would come up from the dives. And I understand that, saying, Let's do the whale shark dance. We want to see whale sharks. I mean, there's so many other amazing things in the water. But, you know, I do get the fascination. So I think people want something that's sure, that's guaranteed.
Yeah.
And that's why Oslo is so popular.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, to be fair, I think people that know about Tubataha and book on a couple of years in advance, you know, they realize that nothing's a guarantee. No matter how many whale shark dances you do, manta waves.
Right. But I mean, on the other hand, I will say that the route that we do off our liverboard that includes Malapascua, I think does not fall short because we move every day. We start in our Darwin location in Atlantis Dumaguete, and then we do Oslo Ben Sumilon, so you do get the whale sharks diving, so no masses there. And then we do kind of altars. Right now we don't do Molball and Pescador, but we do go up to Malapascua and we do Gato Island, which is incredible caverns with white tip sharks sleeping and like really, really cool topography. We do Kalangaman, which is a really nice wall. Obviously, we get the threshers in the morning. And then we kind of go off on the east side, and then we do Cabillao, Balikasag, which is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful dive site in the Philippines, another marine sanctuary with like school of jacks and really great corals, lots of turtles, lots of banded sea snakes, very similar to Apo Island. And then we do Panglao, and we can do Anda. And so there's a lot of other points in the Visayas region that people can go to that are not in the middle of the sea with the deep walls, but have the same amazing biodiversity as Tubatão.
What's to be honest, Ronnie, listening to all this, my mind's fucking blown. That's all these locations that you're listing off are all locations that I've looked at in the past thinking, oh yeah, one day I'm gonna get there. The time from Dumaguete up to Malapascua, is that, do you do that in one kind of hit, or do you
Oh, no,
do
no, 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 no,
stops
no,
along the
no,
way?
no. We do stops along the way. We do stops along the way. So the idea of doing a Visayas route for anyone really is to be able to hit multiple dive destinations that otherwise would take you over a month, right? So the idea is to be able to hit all those points in, 7 to 10 days. And that's really, really unique. It's kind of like your Raja Ampat area, but it's so diverse. The topography is so different. The biodiversity is so vast that really those are. And to me, we also do another route, but we do that on alternating years. And that's Upper Reef and Coron Rex. I don't know if you know, but in Busuanga, which is in Coron Island, we have dugongs. And those are territorial and are very shy. I've been to many places where you would hear of one or you'd seen them from the helicopter, but not in the Philippines. Man, I went diving with them and it's very, very regulated. It's 7 meters depth. Between 5 and 7, you're allowed 20 minutes in the water with them, only 4 divers, somebody watching you on top that you don't get too close. And they just literally, you have to swim away because they're in your face. And that's incredible. Incredible experience. So, we do that route. We leave from Puerto Galera and then we do Apo Reef, which is the second largest marine park in the Philippines. Lots of sharks. So it's 3 islands with the channels, sandy channels in between them, about 30 meters. And then we get the, we get a lot of gray reefs, white tips, black tips, rays, etc. Again, it's you can't get there on day boats, so that eliminates all sorts of fishing. And then we do the Rex and Coron, and then we do Barracuda Lake, which I think is one of the freakiest dive one would do in their lives. I mean,
What?
it's like diving the cenotes, right? Like, do you remember the first time you dove the cenotes? Did you dive the cenotes in Mexico? Do you remember the first time you go in there, like through the freaking jungle? And then you sit down, you go into these like really cold water, and you go in, and then all these games of like lights and cliffy topography, right? And the visibility is like air, and then you get a goldfish swimming. You're like, ooh, it's just so exciting. It's so different, right? And that's Barracuda Lake because it's a landlocked lake.
There's not barracuda in this lake, is there?
There
Get
is
out of
one.
it.
There is one. I mean, at least when I was, yeah, he's like fucking 4 times the size of me. No, probably twice the size of me. Huge barracuda because there's no predators, right? And then the fish is
Because he
obviously
is literally, that's
massive.
literally landlocked, isn't it?
It's landlocked and it's freshwater. And the interesting thing about it, so freshwater is obviously 100% visibility, but the interesting thing about it is that it's reverse thermocline. So at the surface, you're at like 26 Celsius. Start going down, it starts getting warmer. And it's really freaky. So you're not diving with weights and you're not diving with a wetsuit because it's warm. So you do, I did put a rash guard because I was like, ooh, this is, I'm not used to diving in my my bathing suit. And I'm really happy that I didn't. I'll tell you why in a minute. But like you start going down and then at like 10 meters, it's about 30 Celsius, and then 15 meters, like 35, and then 20 meters, you're at 40 Celsius. You're like, you know, it's kind of like the breathing is a bit weird. Yeah. So you kind of spend most of your time at like 10, 15 meters where you're, you know, comfortably warm, but not boiling. And then you see the thermoclines, like these clouds of oil all over. And then it's really? Cliffs, right? It's all these vertical volcanic cliffs. And it's just, topography is insane. It's insane. It's like diving in space. I would imagine, I don't know, I didn't do that in space yet, but you know, that, I would imagine that's how we would look like.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very, very, very freaky. And then you do your safety stop and you got these goatfish and these cleaning shrimps that obviously have no predators. So they're like, ooh, start climbing all over you, pulling your hair. And it's just, yeah, it's just a very different kind of diving, which I really like.
Yeah,
the wrecks are pretty cool. There's a lot of stuff on them. In Coron, and then we do the dugongs, and we do the two wrecks up the Swanga, which have, you know, you could really see, it's kind of like a bit like Palau and Truk, where you could see the silhouette of the boat as you go down.
Yeah. What kind of depths are they at?
So they're about 20 boats or ships. Their average length 120 meters.
Okay.
So it's the entire Japanese fleet that went there to run from the Americans, and most boats sink in the channel, and that's why we don't have the greatest visibility. It's like 10, 15 meters.
Hmm.
But they're under 40 meters.
So 10, 15 meters of visibility would be fantastic in Sydney. That'd be a good day.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, you guys are very particular and strange. It's like the West Coast divers of the United States, you know, they'd be like in January, yay, we're going in the water. Okay. I mean, it's amazing. You get the orcas, you get the seals, you get all these crazy rays, but I'd be a popsicle.
Yeah.
I'm a wuss tropical diver.
Mate, we went diving on Sunday and we did a double boat dive, and the weather had come in a little bit. We didn't, no rain, but it was just cold, cold, biting wind. So yesterday, I was like, death. I just couldn't get warm, snotty. It was horrible. So I think I need to don a dry suit again, or get a heated vest or something like that for the winter times.
I think I would totally do that. And I'm, you know, I'm getting to a point now where I'm, you know, less scared of very cold water. I think I'm gonna start doing some dry suit stuff, especially, you know, kind of like when you go to Oz or West Coast of the United States, you know, places where it would make sense to go diving, but I could never do it without a dry suit.
I
dive 5 mil, 5 mil and a hood in the Philippines.
No, I would be board short. Well, tech shorts and a rashi. That's about it. Yeah.
Tropical wuss.
Soon. Hey, speaking of soon. When we first started talking, you were planning just a familial visit, that kind of thing. Has that been filled up yet?
Are you coming?
Maybe.
Yay!
Has it been filled
up? Then I can show you Verde Island. Can show you Verde Island.
Yeah.
So we do, you know, we do familial trips for dive shop owners and group leaders. Obviously, Atlantis is a little bit different than some of the other operations, where I would say on average, probably 65% of our business is groups.
Yeah.
That's predominantly what we do. On the boat, it's, you know, 90% of the boat is full boat charters.
Mm.
So that's a group, coherent group. But we really know how to run that. We really, really know how to run that. So, you know, you divvy up the divers into groups of six, because that's our maximum ratio is one dive guide, six divers. Mm. Normally they would have their own speedboat, or there'd be two different groups on one bunker boat, if we take the bunkers. So the idea is really to create an exquisite and very personal diving experience. But, you know, kind of going through that routine of getting a group of anywhere from 10 to 50, 60, our largest group was 120 people.
Yeah.
You know, it's we know how to handle those kind of groups. We know how to stagger the day, how to get all the boats running and people out and back on time. We have dedicated camera rooms in both resorts, so people spend their surface interval. I didn't mention that. So we do five dives a day, where everybody goes like, "Oh my God, this is so much. I'm never going to do five." But you know, the setup is so different because we come back to the resort after each dive. And so you've got your coffee, you've got your tea, you've got your cookies, you're in the camera room, and then, okay, it's time to go diving again. So it's not this like long boat rides where you have to surface interval, like you mentioned, on the boat, getting cold, wanting to dry, and then you gotta go to the second dive, you're like, oh my God, I'm not even sure I want to get in the water. But yeah, there's none of that because you're back in the resort, right? And you dry off, and so it's kind of like a liveaboard. It's like boom, 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 boom. You don't want to dive on, fine, you miss it out. Like you don't have to decide in the morning. You just sit out one dive, you go rest, and then you join the next one because they're scheduled, right? So it makes it pretty easy with the surface interval of the resorts.
I've got 10 questions that I've been asking every guest this season.
Ooh.
So why don't we fire into some of those and see how you get on?
10 Commandments.
Yeah.
Hailing down from the sky. Yeah, go.
Okay. How do you describe your job as a diver to people who are not familiar with the activity?
It's a really funny one. So it's a very that's a yeah. Literally, so a lot of times you'd be like, especially because now, you know, we during the pandemic we got stuck in Israel involuntarily, and we made dues. We're fine. And then people would ask, so what do you do? And I go, oh, I work for scuba diving resorts. And you know, Israel being Israel, people do dive quite a lot, and they at least know what it is generally. But then some people go, scuba diving. And you're like, yeah, you know that thing with the tanks. And you're like, oh, you mean like going underwater? Like, yeah. You're like, oh my God, I would never do that. Like, oh, okay. So that's about 80% of the responses that I get. People go, oh, I'm so scared of it, you know, or I'm freaked out by it. But the funniest story is like when I listen to, so my son is in second grade, he's 7 and a half, and when people ask him, what does his mom do? And he goes, my mom's job is to tell people how beautiful scuba diving is, and especially in the Philippines, and where they can see a lot of fish and also whale sharks, because I've been swimming with whale sharks. And that's my job described by a 7 and a half years old. So yeah, that's how I would describe it. You know, the it's not you can do the corporate thing. Oh, you know, I do sales and marketing for Atlantis Dive Resorts, which is a chain of scuba diving resort and a liveaboard, and we tell people why they should dive with us over all the other people. No, that's not my job. Totally not my job. My job is to share with people how amazing the Philippines is. And there's a lot of places in the Philippines that are amazing. Not just where we are, but a lot of places in the world that are amazing for diving, but particularly in the Philippines. And then my job is to explain to people what that the difference between 90 and 100 is 100%. And that's where we excel. Our retention rate is 45%. So 45% of our guests come back. That speaks
That's
a lot. I always
high.
joke and tell people, it's huge.
That is
And I always joke
massive.
and I tell people, I always joke and tell people, look, you know, my job is to get people to come for the first time. It could be very, very hard because we're not just competing over with other operations in the Philippines, right, or other destinations. We're competing with everyone. So let's say you've got a week off or 2 weeks off, and 2 weeks and 2 grand, right? So you'll say, hey, where can I do? Where can I go? What can I do? Right? Philippines could be one option, but there are obviously many, many, many other locations that people want to go to. So, you know, first of all, you're competing with the world. And this is just in the world of scuba diving. Then you've got your competing vacation where you've got a scuba diver who now married, oh God forsake, a non-diver. I don't know how people do that. You know, when I met my partner, he wasn't a diver, and I was like, yeah, mate, I think you, yeah, and he's a dive master now. So it's just like, you gotta level the plane, mate. And so I think, you know, and then you got these guys who are like wandering between, you know, what do we do on school holidays and stuff like that? Should we go a place where that involves scuba diving? What do we do? You know, there's that. And then within the scuba diving world, there's other destination. Within the Philippines, there's other destinations. And in our destinations, there are other operators. So you know, I think my job is to help people narrow that search down, to find something that they will get an amazing experience. I really do believe in it. Yeah. I really do believe that in our world, we create experiences for people.
Yeah.
And that experience, like we just talked about, right? Like you do a double tank dive and you have 12 hours and you're underwater for two.
Yeah.
So with Atlantis, you're underwater for 5 hours a day, but it is 12 hour days,
yeah.
Right? It's 13 sometimes, depending on how much you sleep. So it's kind of creating everything that's around it as well.
Yeah. No.
So
great,
that is
great answer. Great answer. Okay. How about, can you share a memorable diving experience that stands out to you as the best you've ever had?
I've got one that stands out. I don't know if I could say it's
go for it.
The best. I don't believe in the best, you know. There's so many dives I haven't dove yet, and so many dives that I dove that I just came out and said, "Oh my god!" right? No, but I had a so it's kind of like it's a personal story as well. But like we were in Palau, and we decided that we should you know, make some offsprings and make sure that there's more future divers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that industry doesn't die. And we obviously, you don't know, and you're a remote island, and you know, of course you've got pregnancy tests and stuff, but it's not that very, I mean, you're not so entwined into it. You kind of live your life and, you know, off you go. So we had already decided to leave and to go to Costa Rica. Like we took a job in Costa Rica, and
yep.
My partner went a month ahead of me to start, because the restaurant and the resort we ran, the resort was kind of small. It's like really five upscale villas, but the restaurant was massive.
Mm.
It had 95 seats. And, you know, he's a chef, not anymore, but was at the time. So he went ahead of me. And then I didn't know yet, you know, what was going on. I didn't really feel I was in the mass of like packing and, you know, handing down and, you know, all my job for my successor and et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was like, oh my God, I haven't been diving in like a couple of weeks, so I better jump on a boat. Jumped in a boat, went to German Channel. And normally I would stick at the end, kind of like the end of the group, like at least make eye contact and stuff, but kind of stick to myself because you're not guiding anymore and you're not part of the, you know, so I'd be kind of like at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this female gray reef who was just gliding next to me in a really, you know, normally they'd be next to you and then off they swim because, you know, they don't like the noise that comes out of our gear and everything. But she kept gliding, gliding and gliding and gliding and gliding. And so half an hour goes by and we're like literally on the edges of the wall, you know, towards the mouth of the channel or past the mouth of the channel. I think people were looking at mantas. I don't know. It was just like literally her and I.
Yeah.
And at some point I'm kind of like, it was really, really strange. It was really strange. There are lots of sharks in Palau. They do come really close, but they don't stick with you for that long.
Yeah.
And then at some point I'm just kind of looking at her and going, oh my God, I'm pregnant. Got back to, got back to the water, got back with that crazy realization in my head. Went back up, you know, washed my gear, blah, blah, finished my work day, went to the pharmacy, got a test, and there you go.
Lo and behold.
Holy smokes. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think the scientific explanation would probably be that they do feel pulses.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So I think she must have kind of felt two different pulses in one thing. So I think maybe that was, but she just, I don't know. I don't know what it was. But that is a very, very, very memorable dive for me still
that's
to this
awesome.
Day.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, very, very crazy. Yeah.
Okay. If someone wanted to pursue a career similar to yours, what advice would you give them?
Love it. You got to love it. You definitely don't do this for the money.
Yeah.
yeah, no, just love it. Love it. And I think any career, not just mine, just follow your passion.
Very
go with the current. Don't fight it. Don't think about what you do today to do it tomorrow. Look, I came from that world. Like, I was that recreational diver in this high-rolling corporate job with suits and not wetsuits, but real suits. And all this jazz with where you make a lot of money so you can spend a lot of money when you go do the things you love. So I make half the money now, but I am super happy and I do what I love every day. And I think that's irreplaceable for me. You know, people are different. Whatever makes you tick, whatever makes you
Yeah,
tick,
but it's you're right.
do
It's
something
that
that you love.
work-life balance thing that you've got to get going on, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's work-life balance. I think this kind of work is your life. And that's the difference. People talk about
Well, it is for
work-life
you.
balance. No, this is your life. Well, and I think for a lot of people in this industry, right? So I think that's what makes it so special, is people who
I
are
think
really
it's a
passionate
very
about what they're doing.
there's like a murky water between, because like you say, suits, corporate world, 9 to 5, 9 to 6, whatever it is, you kind of know your clock. How, but this industry, because it's not only a job, it's a passion. That 9 to 6 might be 9 to 1 one day if there's nothing going on, but it could be 9 till midnight if you're having a great time with guests and, you know, talking passionately about, well, topics like we're talking about now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't feel like work, you know, and
True.
that's what I really believe in. Doesn't.
Happy days. Okay, if you could change anything about the diving industry or scuba diving in general, oh, what would it be?
That's a big one. I wish divers stopped eating fish. That'd be a first one. No, I think what this industry needs, but has, and it's starting, and I really see it. I really see it, is the connection that we have to the ocean beyond the scuba diving. I think we, because we are there, and like you said, you know, most people don't do it. I mean, realistically, most people in the world don't scuba dive, percentage wise, right? We're a very small percentage of the population. I think it's our job. We're ambassadors. We're ambassadors, and it's our job to tell people, even small things, you know, just the smallest pieces of information that people don't think about because they don't dive. For example, the whole discussion with microplastics and why it's so important to recycle, right? So there is, and I'll give you an example. There's an NGO of 6 local women in Dumaguete. They make jewelry from recycled materials, okay? It's 100% proceeds go to them. Really cool. It's called Lumago. Google them. Support them.
What's
Lumago.
say it again?
Sorry, Lumago, right?
Okay.
And they make these jewelry from anything recycled. They started with paper and then they went on to leather and cotton and stuff. And so recently being the last kind of like 5 years, we support them. So we get some of our giveaways from them.
Okay.
Everything's handmade and 100% proceeds go to them. And 6 families are being fed by those efforts, right? But with the lady that we work with, Flor, she's really awesome. And then so they started doing this these jewelry from recycled plastic. So they got this machine that cuts plastic in different shapes, and they make these amazing jewelry. It's like a hoop, and then it's got these pieces of plastic hanging, but they're all cut in a certain shape. And you've got the blue ones. Those are the Suave bottles, you know, the fabric detergent,
Oh, yeah.
the fabric the laundry softener,
Softener,
fabric, whatever,
yeah.
softener thing. Yeah, softener thing. And then you've got your orange ones are from Tide and the laundry detergent. And then you've got the different ones from, you know, your dish soap, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked about it, and we talked about when to start doing them, and I always buy them. I buy them also personally, and then those my girlfriends know that's what they're getting for their birthdays, collecting their Lumago collection every birthday. And so, you know, I told Flora and I said, well, that's really great. And then we talked about where you get the plastic. And then they said, oh, you know, Mom Ernie, we just go out on the beach and collect it. But there's so much plastic on the beach. And I said, yeah, because obviously they go in the city of Dumaguete. And I said, or in Sibulan, which is by the airport. And I said, yeah, there is. And so, didn't you see that before? And she's like, actually, we almost didn't notice it before, but now we do. So, you know, it's those little things. And there's a saying in the Old Testament that says, if you've changed one soul, it is if you've changed a whole world. And I really do believe in it. Yeah, we're just one person, one little person. Oh my God, what difference can I make? Huge one, huge one. If we all think that we can make a difference, there'll be no difference made. So just do your little part, you know, educate others. I think this industry needs to have more people that are ambassadors for the ocean. You already dive because you love it. You know, talk to your friends about it. Explain to them the importance of recycling. Explain to them the effect of microplastic in the ocean, right? The runoff, using biodegradable materials, avoiding single-use plastic. Man, I'm having this discussion with people here in a first world country.
Yeah.
You know, why single-use?
Do you think,
why?
Do you think the Philippines are now starting to catch up with the Western world on the awareness of single-use plastics? Because I know the finger's been pointed at the likes of the Philippines have been heavy plastic users and dumpers, but...
We are. I mean, we are at the resorts. There's no single-use plastic. Even our straws are bamboo. So we try to do everything kind of locally. All of our toiletries are biodegradable because we're on the boat, you know, and in the resorts close to the ocean.
Yeah.
I think from a population perspective, light years away.
Yeah.
It's just also different economical traits. Look, my master's is in business focusing on international economics, and you look at, obviously totally related to what I do now, right? Mm. You look at consumption graphs around the world, and you know people in third world countries normally get paid every 2 weeks, right? And then you see the consumption graphs go up, right? Because that's when they spend all their money. So savings is pretty flat. Yeah. It's changing, obviously, now with growing middle class. Which is in the Philippines, but predominantly most of the people, they go to the local stores and your shampoo, your laundry detergent, your everything comes in those aluminium single-use lines.
Yeah.
Right? So it's that concept of getting away from that packaging. Everything is wrapped in another thing and another thing and another thing. So, yeah, they're not huge dumpers, to be honest, because a lot of people burn their trash.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, this, you know, like I said, one at a time.
Yeah.
One person at a time. We will make a difference. Yeah. We will.
Yeah. Well said. Excuse me. I mean, the next question was going to be, what are your thoughts on ways to minimize human impact of the oceans? I think we just nailed that one. Okay. So has your passion for diving, or indeed the industry, changed over time, and if so, how?
I think you know, we all do have a moment with where we question ourselves. I think my biggest challenge and the greatest thing, the best thing I did was to stop guiding, honestly.
To stop
guiding? I became
guiding.
This really angry guide. Stop what? Guiding. Yes, I became a very angry guide because people were, was just at the time, this was like the 2012-ish, everybody started getting cameras. You know, it became so accessible, it became affordable, and everybody, even the shitty divers, started diving with cameras. And of course, what do they want to do is take great pictures. Why would you want to take great pictures? There's so many amazing photographers out there. Just go, here you go, this is what I saw, and take a picture from the internet, whatever, right? No, but people want to take their own pictures and their own movies and their own. And in doing that, they... Not deliberately, most people not deliberately, some deliberately, which is ridiculous, you know, break stuff and touch things. And that I kind of became really, really angry guide, didn't want to show anyone anything.
Yeah.
Because I was worried they're going to move stuff and they're going to touch things. They're going to break things. And it was just, I was seeing fins everywhere being, you know, kicking corals. And I was just like, So yeah, that was a really good time to stop guiding.
Yeah.
With that in mind, and I think, you know, that was a turning point for me also to re-understand and re-examine your passion to it. I got when I was guiding in the Philippines 13 years ago, I got hypothermia. I was in the hospital for 4 days. So
the Philippines.
I know it was raining, it was 25 Celsius, four dives a day. I told you. The worst tropical diver. But it was very, very difficult. Well, you get to a point where it's raining and you just look and you go, I don't want to be in the water now. And come on, every single dive professional had that or still has that from time to time. That's normal, you know, that's just how you feel about your job. But I was really happy you making that change and really being able to dive when I want and just go, oh my God, I miss it so much. I have to go to the water. You know, so and that would be a week without diving. So
Fair one.
yeah, I mean you gotta find where your passion is. Some people just love guiding and love teaching, and oh my God, I look at some instructors that I know who are in their 50s and are still so eager to show it to people and overcome difficulties that divers have when they first get in the water. And you know, I think that's amazing. I think we each have our calling and we need to find that.
Okay, here's a good one for you. Of the many
Oh.
safety procedures we have in the industry, if you had to choose one as the most important, what would it be?
I can only speak from like personal incidents, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what runs in my head right now. Two things. Do stay close to your buddy. Stay close to your buddy. And have freaking oxygen on the boat. Have oxygen on the boat. Make sure you dive with somebody that has oxygen on the boat. Make sure that the tanks are serviced. You know, make sure that if does something happen, people know what to do. You know, I had. And this happens. This is just statistics, you know, with over 2,500 dives, you know, you're bound to have stuff happening to you. And so once I had my O-ring exploding at 20 meters, okay. And at that point, you could freak out and go up, and then one would hope that there'd be oxygen on the boat, and that's the rest of your diving holiday is probably pooped. If unless you get, you know, at least you wait for a few days to see what happened. But yeah, I was close with my buddy and we shared air and it was fine and we went up. But the dive operation, actually it was at Atlantis and I was diving as a fun diver, right? Not guiding or anything, or not even leading a group, none of that stuff. It's just fun diving.
But you were working for
I
them
was
by
close with
then?
my buddy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, the dive guides were just amazing. We have two dive guides. There were two dive guides. There was a safety diver, which was one of the dive guides, and within an instant of a second, I had someone with me, you know, holding us two together, making sure that we were fine, surfacing with us, and it was just everything was super smooth. And things like that happen. Things like that happen. It's just statistics. It's like if you drive a car, you will bump into someone else's car at some point, or somebody will bump into you. It's just statistics. So I think diving in an operation that has all those safety trainings and mechanisms in place is super, super important. I dove in the Dominican Republic with someone who was guiding the dive and was just going up and down and up and down and up and down. And I was like, and I was a recreational diver at the time. And I was like, I'm not following that profile. That's fucking bullshit. That's putting me at risk in a remote location off a falling apart boat. Well, it was also me because I wanted to go dive there, but you know, there was definitely no oxygen on the boat. There was definitely no oxygen on land. The nearest hospital was like, I don't even know how far. That was more of an kind of like an expedition thing that I was like, oh, let's go do this. But you know, I think staying safe in general, being close with your buddy, making sure that you're on, especially if you're diving as a recreational diver, make sure that there's oxygen on the boat.
And don't be afraid to ask the
Yeah.
question. Ask
Oh
to make
God,
sure that the
no.
shit's in place, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know how I dive now? When I go diving, like for around my vacation, oh my God, I check everything.
Do you
I check
walk
everything.
on the boat with a
No, but I look around.
checklist?
I look around and they will say, you know, like when I was in Egypt now, they were like, oh yeah, we have oxygen on the boat. And I'm like, oh, okay, awesome. When did you last check it? Because, you know, when I did my dive master in Honduras and we would show up super hungover, he would take a hit of the oxygen. You take a hit of the oxygen. Of course you do. Everybody does it. Don't lie. You've done it if you're a dive professional. You know, everybody. And then when there is an emergency, nobody knows that that bottle is not full. So I'm just saying, like those little things, they make a very big difference in one's life. So, I don't know if I answered your question.
I think so. We got that one. Is one of the most difficult questions you're ever going to answer in your life. What are your top five bucket list destinations?
Places I haven't been to.
No. It can be where you've been or where you want to be. Bucket list.
No, they're all places I haven't been to. That's my bucket list. And that changes all the time, right? It changes all the time as you progress and you go along. So right now, I from places I have been, I'll answer that in twofolds. From places I have been, obviously, definitely. I've got a couple. There's one. There's Palau.
Yep.
Of course. Peleliu, to be particular. Really, really, really nice dive sites. And Oolong Channel. It's definitely one of my favorite. Black Rock in Tubataha.
Okay.
Gato Island off Malapascua with that cavern that you swim through and it's like, then you see the light out. Cenotes in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that dive with the dugongs, man, that was like mind blowing. There's a truck coming your way.
Yeah.
From places I haven't been, Cocos.
Mm-hmm.
Cocos. Sea of Cortez in Mexico. As you can see, colder places. I need to get a dry suit. Right.
Or eat a lot more and get some thermal insulation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I just got a brand new waterproof W7 wetsuit.
Oh, nice.
So good. Oh,
I literally just missed out on one of those this weekend. I got back in touch with a guy and it literally sold like 25 minutes before.
Oh, my! What a wetsuit. I've owned a bunch of wetsuits in my life. That's probably the best I've ever owned.
Agreed.
Yeah, I was not cold for an instant of a second. So Sea of Cortez, Maldives, which surprisingly I haven't been to,
mm-hmm.
Which is strange. Yeah, and all of your region there, PNG.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I hear a lot of good things in PNG. So yeah, these kind of places I haven't been to yet.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's particular locations around the world that are just game changers. You know, Philippines, Indonesia, Galapagos. PNG's right up there for me.
Yeah. Definitely. Mm. Definitely. And I think that kind of, to me, if you dive a place extensively for a few years and you still love it,
mm-hmm.
that's a bucket list.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, that's definitely... definitely Palau in the Philippines.
Yeah.
These two.
Yeah, cool. All right, last one for you. How would you describe the dive community to a non-diver?
A bunch of tattooed individuals wearing jeans and sneakers and trade shows. Drink like fish. Love fish. And... there's just any resemblance between a professional industry, you know, what we think of like a corporate industry, you know, kind of like a, and this world is none to be found.
Yeah.
I think everybody, and I have this discussion with, you'd be surprised, a lot of people. Everybody in this industry loves it.
Yeah.
There's not a single person in it that goes, oh my God, ugh, diving, ugh. No, you can't. Yeah. It's just, and I think that makes a huge difference. Everybody is very laid back,
mm-hmm.
very, very laid back, for better or worse, right? Sometimes I wish there'd be a bit more of a business ethique, just in a way businesses are not being run, but how businesses interact with each other on the B2B world, which is more my world.
Yeah.
There's
huge opportunities there. I think everybody's keen to do B2B, but I think you hit the nail on the head early on when we first started this chat that there's just not a lot of knowledge of how to do it without offending people.
Yeah, I think it's Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Look, I mean, your typical dive operation, small dive resorts, especially in Southeast Asia, is either a retired couple that take their pension and build a small facility, and they love diving, and now they're making it a kind of like a second living in a way, or just a retirement plan. Or you've got your dive professional who've all they've done their lives was to be a dive instructor, and they opened a place, right? There's so much more to diving than that. I mean, honestly, I had a super interesting dinner about a month ago in Singapore with a friend and a customer, and they are focusing on retail. You know, th this is their focus. This is how they run. There is a chain of 11 shops in Japan, MIC21. All they do is retail. I mean, look at you guys in Down Under with Adreno. You know, it's a very, very different model. So I think, you know, it's catching up. It's catching up. There's obviously this industry is comprised of two pillars or three pillars, right? You've got your training, you've got your travel, and you've got your equipment. And those are all in the same industry, but in their own, our own little microcosmos, very different industries in their own, on their own, right? I think the retailers or the manufacturers and retailers are mostly the ones that catch up the most to what's happening in the real world, as we like to call it, right? Because they have to. They have to. They are, you know, I just heard this from one of the manufacturers who told me in the last 3 years since the pandemic and everything that happened, we all know supply chain, blah, 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 but the cost of a chip to put in a dive computer, which is the same chip that goes in the car industry, same chip that goes in many other industries, that factory doesn't discriminate between who they sell it to. There's a price to it, and that's who they sell it, right? Has tripled. Tripled in cost. So, you know, they have to catch up because otherwise they won't be able to compete and off they go. So I think they are the closest ones. And then I think, you know, training, obviously there's a lot of catching up with a lot of the digitalization, right? Like now everything is online and you've got your kind of, you can do your e-learning before you actually do something, and there's that side of the house, right? And then there's a travel side of the house where sometimes, I mean, again, coming from my perspective, sometimes you just go, especially during the pandemic and after, right? Like, let's say you booked a trip and you couldn't go. Are you seriously going to call a Qantas and yell at them that you want your money back because of a force majeure? Or Marriott? Or you would tell Marriott, "Oh, I want to book a room, but I don't want to pay a deposit." Because it's who knows what's going to happen. Are you seriously going to do that? When you purchase your flight, you just purchase your flights, right? To
Jordan.
Jordan, right? So you would not say to the airline, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm gonna pay 10% of my ticket value now, and then the rest maybe a week before I arrive, because who knows what's gonna happen." You're not gonna do that, but yet we're expected to behave by those laws and rules that people think. So I think in that sense, from a business perspective, we're a bit like years back. But that's the charm of it as well, right? That's the whole of it together. It's the good with the bad.
I think an element of that as well is not only the customer holding back on, you know, spending, but the fact that there's been the in-industry battle to get those customers. So it's a very competitive market, and you've always got some arsehole who's going to drop it down as cheap as possible to undercut everyone because they'll take $5 instead of $50 as profit. But then the knock-on effect the customer then sees because they're not getting the quality that they expected. But in a roundabout way, I don't
Exactly.
think it's all on the
And the
customer. I
older we
think it's
grow.
also on those cowboys that are out there doing the shit within the industry. And that's the bit of the industry that we, as people within the industry, need to clean up, quite frankly.
Ooh. So is that if you were to change one thing about the dive industry, is that what you would change? Take the cowboys
All the
out, shoot them
cowboys.
down.
All the cowboys, I'd fucking close them down now. Because it's the cowboys that will more than likely be the issues with people getting injuries as well. And lack of training. Well, look at me getting on a little soapbox.
No, but it's But it's true. It's true, you know, and people don't see that. You know, what people see is they go on vacation for a week and that's it. And the, you know, and that's normal. Like if I would go on to buy a car, then I wouldn't necessarily see all the bits and pieces behind it, right? Because it's not an industry for me. This is just a one-off activity or once a year activity, if you ask my dad, who's total lost three cars in the past 3 years. But I'm not, none was his fault. None of those was his fault. Yeah, which is ridiculous. But I think, you know, those things, and it goes back to the question you asked me about safety. Look, we had a lady, this is, oh my God, 4 or 5 years ago. She asked us for a quote. You know, she was coming to Dumaguete. She asked us for a quote. Look, we're not cheap. Nor do we want to be. We have an excellent product, which is excellent value for money. It's a safe dive operation. It's a great resort to stay in, and the staff is exquisite. I am at a point in my life where I would pay a little more to have a great product. I would. And that's how I shop. You know, that's how I shop. Like my, you know, I would buy organic honey where places where I know the bees were treated right. I will invest more in getting, you know, something that aligns with my beliefs. So, for example, all the biodegradable cleaning products, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? You would pay more for things that are important to you. So it should carry on to your travel experience. Of course, we all like good deals. Everybody likes a good deal, right? Everybody likes to buy on sale. But on the other hand, when you think about, you know, this is your vacation, the delta, like we said before, the difference between 90 and 100 is sometimes 100%. So you want to really think about it. And I think the older you grow, you kind of go, yeah, I want to have a comfortable bed. I want to, you know, little things that matter, right, to us old people. Anyway, this lady contacted us. We gave her a quote. She said, yeah, no, it's too expensive, whatever. She went with one of those cowboys, as you call them, one of those pirates with a freaking compressor on the beach and some falling apart boat, and going back to oxygen on the boat. Had an incident underwater. Dive guide didn't even pay attention. I think that the dive guide actually was a dive master, but without any insurance, of course, nor did the operation. And then she surfaced, and then she got on the boat, and she was like, "Look, I think I got bent." And they were like, "Oh no, there's no way you got bent." And she's like, "Can I have some oxygen?" They were like, "No, we don't have oxygen on the boat." And then she said, "Look, I really think this was an Apo Island, right? So there's no hospital, none of that stuff. Like you need to get back to Negros, which is 45 minutes away." But the guys were like, "Well, yeah, we're really sorry, but there's one more dive to do, so you don't have to dive this dive. You just sit on the boat and wait."
Oh, Jesus.
She sat on the boat. By the time she got to the hospital, it was about 5 hours later. She had to go to Cebu to the chamber, where she ended up with 10 treatments, which is quite a lot. So just saying, you know, have those things in mind when you go, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna go for a 20, you know, $20 dive." Excellent. But there is a lot of things in the operation behind it. And you know, I love my life. I've got my bucket list. I want to go see my bucket list. I don't want to lose out on anything for a couple $100. So
Exactly,
that's just me.
exactly. Yeah. Well said. And on that note, I think we'll wrap this bad boy up, shall we?
It's a bad girl, but yeah.
Yeah,
Or rather, a good girl. Let's wrap this good
yeah.
girl up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, folks. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'll put the links in the show notes and everything like that you can get hold of Ronnie and wing your way to the Philippines. And I promise you, I'm going to be 99% away there already of sorting out a group kind of expedition in the next 12, 18, 24 months, something like that. So keep your eyes peeled on the website, and we'll see what we'll do. We'll work together and make something happen.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for so much for listening, guys. And go to the Philippines. Go dive the Philippines. Love it. Embrace it. Enjoy every moment.
And we'll finish on that one. Fantastic. Thanks very much for your time. And I'll speak to you soon. Ciao,
This
everybody.
is Scuba Go Under the Sea, the podcast for the inquisitive diver.